This is Weekend Let's Hear It on WMUK. I'm Kara Lawrence. Thanks for coming along. The Kalamazoo Nature Center is the venue for a program of live music and photography by composer Jim Spalink, whose blend of Celtic and classical music will be performed by a group of 8 musicians on Sunday. I'll talk with Spalink and his collaborator, Carolyn Keeble, later in the program. But first, one of the most insatiably curious classical pianists of today is Marc-André Hamelin. It's a quality that can be overlooked with Hamelin, who has a reputation for coolly surmounting the most difficult music while other pianists are left gasping in his wake. The French-Canadian pianist has recorded over 70 albums, many of which feature works by composers whom history has put on the sidelines. But he doesn't neglect the greats, either. Tomorrow, Marc-André Hamelin will appear on the Gilmore Keyboard Festival's Piano Masters series in Chenery Auditorium, playing works of Mozart, Debussy, Schubert, and Hamelin himself. I spoke to him about the recital and his recent activities. Where do I find you right now? Where are you speaking to me from?
I am home, actually. I'm just outside Boston. And I'm here for a week before I go off again. Just before the Gilmore recital, I'll be playing at Roosevelt University in Chicago. It's a recital as well.
Can you cast your eye backward and tell me about your travels in the last month or during the summer?
Mm-hmm. Well, I had a week with the Gothenburg Symphony in Sweden, which was one of the nicest experiences I've had recently. I mean, first of all, the orchestra was wonderful, so was the conductor. The acoustics of the hall are stupendous, and they had two instruments, two German Steinways, which were equally incredible. And I used one for the concerto, which was the Brahms' first concerto, and then another one, the other one for a recital that I did for them as well. And I went to Copenhagen for a piano recital, and after that, I played the Brahms' first concerto again in Montpellier with the orchestra in France, and I also did the Portland, the Oregon Symphony, excuse me, in Portland, and the Indianapolis Symphony. So this is all within the past month and a half or so.
You've balanced many kinds of music making as a solo recitalist, as a chamber musician, recently with the Takash Quartet and Pacifica, and as an orchestral soloist. Have you found the right balance in your life right now?
I think so. I think so. I mean, my only dream left, really, because as far as repertoire, I've done pretty much everything I want to do. Of course, you know, I will still be discovering new things, you know, and learning new repertoire. But as far as what I've wanted to do, I think that's sort of accomplished in some cases many times over. Mm. But my desires, my career desires, really lay more in the area of expanding my horizons as far as playing with new orchestras and new conductors and also new recital series.
So you have laid your eyes on a vast amount of sheet music. I've heard you enjoy discovering obscure pieces by composers who pretty much vanished for a time.
I'm not necessarily boasting about this, but I have at the moment about 100 crates of sheet music.
It's not an exaggeration.
It's accumulated since I was about, 13 or 14 years old.
For me, if you opened a score for piano and sat me down in front of it, the struggle would immediately begin of trying to remember how bass clef goes and all of this immediate technical problems. But for you, it's a lot more like you open the page and it talks to you?
Well, first of all, I do have perfect pitch, which facilitates inner hearing a great deal. And I'm also a composer, and this enables me to write away from the instrument. I mean, I can't always hear really completely perfectly because I always have to check myself. stuff afterwards, but it does help. It helps me because I don't always have an instrument at my disposal when I write music. But I also have sort of a visual sense of music, and the visual sense of it was also absorbed very quickly when I was a young boy. So all of this sort of combines. So I can evaluate music relatively quickly when I look at the score.
Can you evaluate the composer's personality? Do you get a sense of what kind of person this would be to talk to or to be friends with?
It's a misleading concept, really, because Mozart was not really the man that we see in the music, as we all know. So it's not necessarily indicative of what he was. You know, that the music, if you look at the music, and some composers wrote very optimistic music in the most tragic portion of their lives. So it's a little bit dangerous to think that way, I think. So just to answer your question in a way, sometimes the music, the personality, the character of the music itself will jump off the page, but it doesn't always. I mean, it sort of depends, of course, on the composer. It depends on the music.
I think if I were to reword that, it wouldn't be, does a specific piece give you a sense of the personality, but when you do a complete overview, when you go through the works as a big session of looking at a specific person's music, can you help but create a sort of character that comes along with you that is your idea of that composer?
Well, certainly it will help. I mean, it's in a way, I mean, you have to do everything you can to form as complete picture as possible of the context. You have to create a context, an emotional context in which to within which to perform these pieces, and every little bit of information, I think, helps. But it is generally underestimated how much is actually contained in the score itself without any outside help. If you really read between the lines, I mean, there is still a lot of information to glean from the score that one wouldn't necessarily suspect at first.
Can you think of an example?
No. I'd have to get too technical and specific.
Sure. Well, I am glad you brought up Mozart, because it is a Mozart sonata that begins this absolutely beautiful program that you will present on November 5th. It begins with Mozart, continues with the Pavane Varié, one of your own works. Then comes the Debussy Image Book 1, and closes with Schubert Piano Sonata, the last sonata by Schubert. So we will start at the beginning and talk about the Mozart Sonata, which is also his last. And yet with Mozart, he wasn't really expecting this or anything to be his last work.
No, and there were a few years between that and his death, of course. I mean, he was very much concerned with things like the Magic Flute and the Requiem. He is a sort of got away from the keyboard a little bit at that point.
Where do piano sonatas actually lie in importance with Mozart's output, do you think?
Well, in general, every single one of them is a very exquisitely wrought work, but in general, they're not quite as highly regarded as the piano concerti. And in a sense, I think that is a mistake, because speaking personally, when I started to explore them, I thought that they were such a wonderful treasure trove. Delights were waiting for me at every corner. I mean, I didn't necessarily know them all that well, you know, because I'd only learned perhaps two or three in my formative years. And when I really started to explore them, I realized what gold there was in there.
after the Mozart, you'll perform a very special work, one that you composed yourself, the Pavane Varié, which is fairly new, 2014?
Yes, that was actually a commission for the from the Munich ARD competition. And it was performed by four semifinalists in September 2014.
Right, you got to hear four different interpretations.
Yes, I wasn't there, unfortunately, because I was playing in Copenhagen the same day, but through the miracles of computer technology, you know, the music was actually, the competition was streaming. And I didn't hear it that day, but I heard it the next day. I heard all four performances.
What was it like to hear your work performed?
Well, it told me a great deal, some of it good, and some of it, well, you know, when you realize that you haven't notated the music or well enough or suggested things well enough interpretively, you know, it's a little bit disappointing. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you know, so I revised the music ever so slightly after I heard these performances, just so that my score could be clearer and would represent my intentions better.
I see that you dedicated this piece to another incredible but self-deprecating pianist, Emmanuel Axe. Are you friends with Mr. Axe?
Oh, yes, very much. I mean, he is an absolutely wonderful person, as you probably know. I mean, he is very modest. I mean, he's one of these people who are absolutely impossible to compliment. But, I mean, he has done some... what he's done is of such magnitude, you know, and I'm really proud to call him a friend.
Tell me about the theme on which it's based.
It's a pavane from the French Renaissance, and it's really one of the most well-known themes to have come out of that period. It's usually heard in a choral setting, and the authorship is not absolutely established.
It's a slow, stately dance.
Yes, and it's really quite haunting, and I always wanted to do something with it. I mean, my sketches for this piece date back from the early 90s, but I'd never done anything with it. I mean, I'd always intended to do a set of variations, but as far as a scale, I mean, I didn't know back then what form it would take exactly. And I remember writing a few variations back then, but the bulk of the work really is more recent.
Well, I've listened to it a couple of times, and I do lose, you know, the theme itself, which happens in modern variations that no matter what, I get lost.
Yeah. And yet, well, the thing is, you won't necessarily have the melody, but the harmonic structure is always there.
I also was struck by how the theme of the pavane and the opening of the Schubert sonata go in the same direction.
Well, that's something, you know, that's something I've never noticed before. Thank you.
Da 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 da, sort of.
Da di da 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 da, and then the pavane is da di da di da da. Hot damn. Sorry.
No, that's brilliant programming.
That's cool. Yes, if I say so, if I don't say so myself, because I didn't plan it that way. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no, it's...
I'll make a point of that from now in the future.
So with this final sonata by Schubert, I am going to try once again to read life events into the music, although that's a dangerous thing, as you said before. In this case, I think because he knew he was ill, we might be able to read a little bit into this idea of his own mortality being present in the piece.
Yes, but it also is, on the other hand, a work of such optimism. the last two movements just bring us back to a sense of life enhancement. You know, that we can't completely read the work in that spirit, I think.
Any final thoughts on this program and visiting Kalamazoo again that occur to you?
Well, the experiences I've had so far have been extremely pleasing, and it's such a wonderful experience to be in a place which just vibrates piano, you know, so much. I mean, everything is piano, and I just love the way the festival is run. What can I say? And I'm thrilled to be part of it again.
It's so contradictory in a way, where people like me in the media want to make someone of your abilities out to be sort of a tortured, remote, man-in-a-castle artist. And
far from it.
That's Marc-André Hamelin performing at the Van Cliburn Series. He appears tomorrow night on the Gilmore International Keyboard Festival's Piano Masters Series in Chenery Auditorium beginning at 8 o'clock. You're listening to Weekend Let's Hear It on WMUK. I'm Cara Laurence. Next, we'll take a look at an event coming up on Sunday at the Kalamazoo Nature Center. It blends live music, played by eight musicians on a variety of strings, winds, and percussion, with projected home photography. The music and the photography are by Michigan folk musician Jim Spalink. He's a founding member of the Celtic fusion group Andro. I spoke to Spalink and Andro percussionist Carolyn Keeble about Jim's music last fall when it had just been released on CD. He admitted the project was a highly personal one.
Oh, yeah, it is quite personal and therefore terrifying. Actually, it's sort of, this is music that I've done that's been extraneous to the Andro stuff. It's it didn't really fit in a folk band setting. I take a lot of pictures of nature, and I have a huge artist morgue, if you will, of nature sounds. I record nature sounds and I incorporate it in the music, and I put them, most of them, on YouTube, and I guess that's what makes this a little. I'm thrilled to do it, and I'm proud of it, but I also feel quite naked because it's to throw something in the vast sea of YouTube is one thing. It's anonymous, and there's you at least have the illusion of some degree of anonymity, but. When you actually work this hard on it and you work with really fine musicians and you put it out there to friends and family and stuff, it takes a whole different bent, I guess.
Jim, I'm curious about how and where you go to record natural sound in Michigan.
I've always been outdoors a lot, lots of hiking, lots of the beach, lots of backpacking, and I always take, it's easier now because actually the camera on my phone is better than any camera I have, so I always pretty much have it with me, but I've always taken like a small field recorder and just the anticipation that there might be something that I could get, and often, you know, I used to work in construction, and occasionally I'd get on a job site and I'd hear geese or sandhill cranes or something outside, and in my lunch hour I'd go out and record them just to get a sample that I might, you know, be able to use someday in music.
Has it become harder and harder over time to find places and quiet enough to record?
That's a big problem because you don't. Often you think that it's very quiet because, you know, I think our modern ear is, has sort of tuned out, you know, a passing jet or distant traffic. But you sure realize that when you record it and listen back that it's not quite as quiet as you thought it was. So it's very difficult to get a pristine sound.
About your background as an instrumentalist. We see you playing harp and guitar and much more on this new album.
I'm self-taught in everything. I haven't had any musical training. I guess I'll always consider myself primarily a guitarist. That was the first thing that I played, and it sort of branched out into Renaissance lute because the two are so related, and I came to admire a lot of the Elizabethan music, which is transcribed for guitar from the lute music, so I just sort of backtracked it. And one, you can play several. Usually a guitar player can sort of play banjo and sort of play mandolin, and we all, 90% of it is the, you know, getting the fingers to move on the frets and such, and the rest is just different tunings.
So, Carolyn, I'm wondering if you can tell the story of how Jim's personal compositions and videos on YouTube turned into a studio project involving many, many more musicians to get the sound you wanted.
Well, I'm of the opinion that if you're a vibrant, functioning group, you should be recording approximately an album a year to document your artistic process and to have something to kind of carry you forward and to really give you some grounding in your work. And we had just come off of two different creative projects. One was a collection of live recordings. And then from there, we went quite a bit in the opposite direction with an album of reflective, meditative improvisations. And so when you split the difference between those two worlds, somehow we ended up here. And quite a few of the pieces that Jim had reference tracks for struck me as pieces that had a lot of potency and potential, but were rather Muzak-y in their existence, you know, because a lot of these were things he's creating at home with a keyboard, a synthesizer, or some kind of means to create a musical referent, but that by no means represented the depth and character and true personality of these tunes without a live string section or an actual brass ensemble or a set of ilium pipes that could create that unique emotion that only they can do.
This album for me lives between folk music and classical music. I'm drawn to the layered nature of it, the instrumentation, and you know, the big ambitious pieces for my classical side. And of course, the beautiful melodies are like really make my Celtic side happy. But it's kind of unusual.
Well, it lives there because that's where I live. I've grown up with vast amounts of classical music as well, and I listened to that and played that before I started playing Celtic music. So,
I imagine some of the musicians that were working on the pieces were thinking or saying even the same thing. This is somewhere in between.
Most of them really had a lot of fun doing it, I think, as well, because we tended to recruit people who you might consider from a resume standpoint as being classical players, but who from a musician perspective love to play all styles and sorts of music. And as a lot of musicians tend to be very interested in moving into new expressive spaces as well. So it was great to hear that they had such a fun time exploring this music too.
But it's also intimidating as a folk musician to tell people that are that accomplished what to do. It's not easy for me. I was pretty intimidated by them, but they were kind to me.
One of the centerpieces of the album that includes brass and strings and Illan pipes is called Big Sable Light or Big Sable Light. Would you tell me about that?
It's up near Ludington. It's by Hamlin Lake. Absolutely beautiful lighthouse. I think it was 1885 that was built. We played for several. They have a concert series up there. And we played for several of those. And as part of our stipend for playing up there, we all could stay overnight in the lighthouse. It was beautiful. It was absolutely... I spent the whole day getting sound recordings and taking pictures and just sort of hanging out there. It was a perfect day. It's a very majestic place and a very strong sense of history. It's interesting because I was talking about ghost stories and such, because you think of the lighthouse as being a really lonely place. Usually it's only the lonely lighthouse keeper and his family. And I was talking to the keepers there about just that. And they said, no, if you think about it, there are hundreds, maybe thousands of shipwrecks right off from this point. So this is, many people have perished. That's why they saw the need to put a lighthouse there. So they said, this would be the first area of human energy or human activity that those people would come in contact with, if there were such thing as ghosts. But it kind of, it adds to the mystery of it, I think. It adds to the feeling that it's something that's older and more relevant and bigger than you are.
Musician Jim Spaulding spoke about his piece Big Sable Light, inspired by a Michigan lighthouse. You can hear Spaulding and his group Andro and Friends at the Kalamazoo Nature Center on Sunday at 3 o'clock with a program of live music and photography by Jim Spaulding. I'm Kara Lawrence. This is WMUK's Weekend Let's Hear It. Thanks for tuning in.